The Scapegoats Podcast, the show where Josh, that's me, talks about some things Yu-Gi-Oh! For a little while. Today, we are going to be talking all about some of my problems with the game, some of the things that I have to complain about. We did do an episode like this, I think really early on this year, but I didn't get to talk about everything I wanted to talk about. And I feel like the ban list that just came out recently is a perfect segue to talk about something like this. Before I get into it, though, firstly, apologies for this episode being, I guess you could call it late. You know, I've been trying to stick to that like Monday schedule, but it just kind of worked out last week that I put out like five different little pieces of content, and I needed a little bit of a break. And after I record this episode too, I know a lot of you guys have like sent some messages in like Discord, Twitter, stuff like that. If I haven't responded to you, I am so very sorry. It's been very busy, but I will get to each and every one of you after that. And thank you guys as well, just, you know, for like, I know, especially after last Monday's first episode where I kind of go into the details, a lot of you guys have kind of given like your thoughts, your opinions and your support and whatnot. And I really appreciate that, as well as all you guys that are leaving reviews. I promise, even though I haven't read them on the podcast here, I do read them. I love them. Like I said, always the most rewarding part of these things. And excuse me. And you guys are the best. So I probably won't edit this too much, so you're going to hear me cough, you're going to hear me take drinks, you're going to hear me sigh, I don't know, whatever. But, you know, of course, we on the scapegoat side of things, right, I know we're kind of coming up towards the end of September already, and I think end of September might be a little bit too soon to cut it off. It might bleed into October a little bit, because like I said, like really early on, I think me and Emerson both want to make sure like all of our other stuff is kind of ready to go, or I guess, you know, I do, before I stop making podcast content, because I have an itch to make content and I don't want to be without it for a while. So yeah, and I'm still planning on the last episode kind of just being like a really large Q&A where you guys can ask as many questions as you want per person, and I want to take as much time to answer every single one in as much detail as I can. So that might be a multiple hour episode to kind of kind of end things, I guess. But, you know, we'll see when we get there. I'll let you guys know. And yeah, before I jump into the topic, though, I feel like it's good to have a warm up. Sienna's behind me. She's in the same room while I'm recording this, just chilling. She said hello. I don't know if my mic picked it up. Hopefully you guys enjoyed her being on the episode. We both had a lot of fun doing that. But Sienna, please give me a warm-up question for today.
Would you rather live in a world where it constantly snows or always rains?
Okay, so she asked, would I rather live in a world where it constantly snows? Where it constantly snows or always rains. Okay, this is a much better question than the fish question, in my opinion. What do you think?
You don't want it to rain.
Well, not for me, like you. Oh. You yourself, yeah.
I'd want it to snow.
She'd want it to snow. This sounds like to them that I'm just talking to myself, probably. I don't think my mic is picking you up at all. But you said snow?
Yes.
Why?
The snow's pretty and the sun can come out when it snows.
The snow's pretty and the sun can come out when it glows and it'll glisten. Okay, I mean, yeah, that's good logic. That's tough. I'm a big fan of both, actually. Here in Kentucky, where we live, the weather, we kind of get all of the weather, right? We get, just being in the middle of America, it gets really hot, it gets really humid, it can get very rainy, it can also get very snowy in the winter. I would probably say snow as well, because my favorite type of weather actually is like really overcast, like no sun out, just kind of gray, looking like it's about to rain. Like, I don't know why I like that, but I like that. But the thing is, if it's always raining, I don't really like getting wet, and I would just get wet everywhere I went. So I'd rather it snow, and I also think snow is prettier. So, yeah. Okay, well, that made me feel nice and juiced, so I guess we can just jump into this thing. I guess the first thing, though, to talk about is, you know, the ban list that came out. There wasn't really much to it. I've seen a lot, and I mean a lot, of hate on social media for this ban list, and I kind of get it. It's a little peculiar to me, though, because I didn't think any of the hits or any of the things they did on the list itself were bad. There just wasn't a lot of them. And it kind of got me thinking, like, it seems like the problem that is on the forefront of everybody's minds at the moment concerns banlists, right? And it's not just the fact that I think everybody has their own version of cards that make Yu-Gi-Oh! Fun and styles that make Yu-Gi-Oh! Fun that they want to see hit or unhit, but it has to do with, like, how these banlists are handled by Konami. And I'd be lying if I didn't say, like, I felt the same way at different points. You know, I'm less involved in the competitive scene of the game now, so ban lists don't matter as much to me, but they also are some of the most fun content to make, right? And they're some of the most popular content to consume, right? Like, everybody rushes to their favorite YouTubers, content creators, whatever, to get their take on these new ban lists that drop. So, you know, I would say it's a problem. The biggest thing is we don't really know when they're going to come. You know, Konami kind of gives, let me actually pull the ban list up right now and see what they say. Usually it's like a few months from now or something like that. Yu-Gi-Oh! Ban list. Let's see. Okay, Forbidden and Limited lists. Load, load, load. Got my Spectrum Wi-Fi working overtime here. Three tabs open. Gotta hydrate. Don't forget to hydrate. Okay, effective from September 25th, which that actually is still like a week from now, well, even when I'm recording this, the previous will remain in effect. The next update after this will be in a few months, right? Like, what does that mean? It's September. Let's count October, November, December. Could it be in 3 months? Is that a few? Could it be in February where it's 5 months? Could it be in April, which is seven? Like, you just have no idea, right? And I feel like it wouldn't really be that hard to just kind of give, like, I don't know, some kind of, like, closer or more concrete frequency of when they're going to release ban lists. But the interesting thing about that, too, is I think there's pros and cons to that, right? So, like, at the end of the day, I think people need to keep in mind and remember, like, Konami, Yu-Gi-Oh! Is just a branch of what Konami, the company, has and does. And Konami, the company, is a business whose purpose exists to make money, right? And to make as much money as possible, to make their margins look as good as possible, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, health of the game is probably pretty far down on the pecking order, while it's not a problem. And what do I mean by that is, like, as long as I've been in Yu-Gi-Oh!, I think every year outside of, like, the COVID era, of course, I think it has grown by a good amount too. So, like, the game seemingly, at least from what I know, just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And so the way they're probably looking at this is like, well, we don't give them, you know, we don't communicate with the community at all. We don't give them ban list times. We don't give a F about the health of the game necessarily, unless something is just too big to ignore. And it doesn't matter, right? Like, it's growing anyway. So why would we put in that extra effort when it seemingly doesn't matter? And I mean, that might be a good argument, honestly. Like, I don't really know. I don't know if them saying, hey, we're going to do a ban list once every quarter, every 3 months, basically. What is that? 3, 6, 9, 12. Yeah, that's a full year. I don't know if them saying that actually brings in more players to the game. Maybe, maybe not. But one of the cons of something like that is I think they might even like the idea of not the players not knowing when the ban list is going to come out, because Konami can be a little bit unpredictable, right? For example, they hit Super Heavy Samurai really early into its lifespan, and it was, from what I know, again, I didn't pick it up, but, like, a pretty cheap deck. So, you know, I guess in that case, no harm, no foul if you, like, picked up the core, but nobody really expected that, and it happened pretty quickly. And if they were to schedule out ban list dates like that, then I think, especially if it coincides with, like, new support coming out for an archetype, a new set coming out, it might impact those things negatively, right? Because I can tell you right now, Power of the Elements, Sprite, Tier Limit, when those came out, everybody pretty much knew before they even hit that these were going to change the game, that these are a step up from everything else that we have. And if you want to play competitively, you have to get these cards. Well, if there was a ban list right around the corner, either before or after that set, I think you would have less people invest into it, right? Because it's like, well, hold on. We don't want to buy the Sprite cards because what if, you know, 3 weeks into their lifespan, Konami hits Sprite Starter or something? And, you know, at that point, it's still probably the best deck by far, but you never know. right? And so it impacts their sets. But the thing is, when you have these unpredictable ban lists, the fact that you don't know when it's going to come is almost like a motivating factor for you to go ahead and just buy the cards. Because you would say, like, oh, well, it's unlikely that Konami wants to hit something early. And who freaking knows? Like, the last ban list was in May, and they said the next one's in a few months. Is that... because when did Power of the Elements come out? I think it was the end of August last year. It's like, is that long enough? Is it not? Who knows? And, yeah, you know, I don't want to spend, like, the whole episode, like, talking about the ban list just because this was, you know, top of mind for everybody. But, you know, it's one of the reasons I think that we may never get that from them. We may never get a specific, hey, we're going to release a ban list on this schedule. Because I just think, like, I don't know that it affects buying product in a positive way at all, really. You could kind of flip that and say, like, oh, well, if a ban list comes out before a set releases that hits all the best decks and then Sprite tier release, then it makes it even more desirable. So I guess it does work the other way, but it's just tough, right? And at that point, it incentivizes them even more to only make hits to sell product, which they probably already do. But imagine if before every core set, which we get, what, four of those a year? If before every core set they released a ban list, why would they not just hit all the best decks at that point? So the stuff immediately coming out in that core set is now the best of the best and needs to be bought, right? So I just think it's kind of a double-edged sword when people are like, hey, we want to know exactly when this ban list is coming, because I just think that incentivizes Konami even more to not actually care about the health of the game and just, you know, their singular mindset of being what's going to sell the most product. And you can tell that that's not always the case. Like, that's probably their number one priority all the time, but there's at least a little bit of what is healthy for the game in there. And I think maybe having those set ban list dates could remove that entirely. I don't know, though. Right. I'm not a businessman. But also, just, you know, regardless of that, it's just the communication in general is terrible. Right. I think it would be really cool. I think, do they do this for Master Duel? You guys will have to let me know. But like, when they hit stuff, do they give a reason behind it? I think that would be really cool to have, like, a little write up of, like, hey, here's why we hit these cards. Here's the point of that. And here is, you know, why we maybe didn't hit some of these other popular cards. Another game I play, Clash Royale, which I'm not, like, very into, like, competitively, but I picked it up recently for some reason, and I'm really liking it. What they do, and they are not much better than Konami, honestly, in totality, but what they do is before they make balance changes to their cards in their game, they will put the changes that they're wanting to make out there into the community for the community to react to. Now, whether they actually end up changing their minds based on what the community says, you know, it's hit or miss. But that's something that's really cool of, like, hey, here's what we're thinking of doing. What do you guys think about that? And then when they hit something, it's like, well, we're hitting it because this. But to kind of close out the ban list discussion, like, one, I didn't think the last one was that bad. I think I gave it, like, a 3, which is pretty low, but, like, I wasn't, like, outraged about it. But I do think Konami's missing an opportunity to make this, like, a big event, honestly, just across the community. Because, like I said, banless content, and I can see this from the other side now. One, it's really easy to make for the creator, right? So it's not, you know, it's not a joke for creators to be like, oh, it's, you know, it's banless season. I've been looking forward to this, because they do. It's really easy, right? You can talk about what you want to see on the list as far as, like, a wish list. Then you can talk, like, a prediction of what you actually think you're going to see. You can live react to the list, and then you can talk about the list after you live react to it. So that's, like, 4 big pieces of content that people will consume every single bit of because people care about the ban list so much. It shakes up the game so much, right? And I almost kind of view it like they could do something, especially if they had, like, certain dates that they wanted to drop it on, like a Nintendo Direct almost. You know, I don't know about you guys. I'm not really a big gamer, but even though that's the case, when a Nintendo Direct comes on, me and CN will usually hop on and try to watch it, right? Because it's like, oh, what new games are coming out? Remakes, whatever. I don't know. And I kind of feel like Konami could turn it into something like that, of, like, what everybody looks forward to. If Konami had, like, a social media presence or, like, an online presence, a YouTube presence, and they could, you know, invite creators to, like, come and talk and react together, or just put out a video of, like, hey, here's all the new stuff that we're thinking of doing in the game. Also, at the end here, here's a ban list for everybody to react to at the same time. I think it'd be pretty cool. But, you know, I'm not Konami's marketing guy. So maybe Yu-Gi-Oh! Is just not big enough for them to, like, dedicate those kind of resources to it. But who knows? Who knows? But anyway, that'll kind of wrap up the ban list side of it. My real complaint, I guess, with Yu-Gi-Oh! You know, overall, I can say right now, I always have an itch to play Yu-Gi-Oh! Right? It rarely goes away, the desire that I have to pick up a deck of cards and play against somebody. It's really fun, right? I love it. But especially within the last few years, that feeling, it's like I have it, but then I think about actually going to play in the format that we're currently in, whatever format that is, you know, and it kind of like, it discourages me, right? It's like that feeling, it doesn't go away. It's like I have a Yu-Gi-Oh! Itch, but I don't have a great way to scratch it because I don't really love where the game has gone. Excuse me, most recently. And honestly, like, I'm kind of wondering if everybody that started playing Yu-Gi-Oh! At a certain point has felt and is feeling that and has either had to get over it or just move on to a different game, because I started in 2016, right? Which doesn't feel that long ago for me, but that's 7 years at this point. 2016, very late 2016. So, you know, maybe call it 6.5 years, been playing Yu-Gi-Oh! So far. And even then, I kind of had some problems with especially those like really combo heavy type decks, not because I'm just biased against combo. I'll kind of explain a little bit later, but it's like, and we've gotten so far from that point that I was already kind of looking at as being like, well, I like some of this, but some of this is too far. And now we're 7 years past that. Right. And really, I think it just comes down to like one-sidedness. That's kind of like the big thing that I have written here, which I didn't really prep much for this episode. If you can't tell, I've just been jumping from point to point to point. But just one-sidedness. I don't really have much here, but it's just too one-sided. Yu-Gi-Oh! Is just too one-sided on a large scale for me to like it, right? It's like when you play, I don't know, checkers. It's like both sides, you make one move, then the other person makes a move. It's interactive, right? It's back and forth. There's not these long turns. And there's also a lot of strategy involved, right? And a lot of like seeing ahead as to what your opponent's going to do, setting traps for them, etc., etc. And in Yu-Gi-Oh! It's just like, oh, I lost the die roll. I better open two hand traps. Oh, I didn't. Okay, I guess I lost the game. Let's scoop and go to game two. Game two, I'm going first. Hopefully my opponent didn't open two hand traps. Oh, they did? Damn, I guess I just lose the match. Oh, they didn't? Okay, I'm going to combo off and win. Game three, oh man, I better open my going second cards. Damn, I only opened one, and my opponent sided in judgment and had that for my breaker card. Okay, you know, match over, right? Like, there are, and again, like, there's always an exception to like when someone says something, like when I'm giving this example, there's always exceptions that you could bring up and say, excuse me, and say something like, well, you know, I played against an Eldritch deck at locals last week, and but all of our games went to turn 12 before anybody won, and it was really nice back and forth. Like, that's definitely a thing. But by and large, it just feels so one-sided. And you guys know, like, Sky Striker is my favorite deck of all time. And one of the reasons for that is it's very good at going first and second, right? You know, something like Widow Anchor, you can set it. It's a disruption going first or going second. You can use it to try to play through a board and, you know, get your engages live, resolve your engages, and try to win through advantage. And so it did a really good job at not making me feel like I had just auto lost the game if I didn't win the die roll. But even with Striker around, you know, there's a ton of decks where that still applies to. Basically any like intense combo deck that you have, Dragon Link, maybe not Dragon Link as much because they do put out a board, but they're also really big on follow up. But it just feels so one-sided. It just feels so one-sided and I don't like it. Floodgates also have a lot to do with that, right? Especially in the side deck. You have Labyrinth right now, which is a good deck that can play Floodgates. I don't actually think the best version of Labyrinth really plays Floodgates, but, you know, I guess that's up for debate, maybe like a skill drain or two. But like outside of that, we don't really have it. It's more so like, oh, I'm going to side anti-spell. And that just, you know, ends the game. If you activate it and your opponent has spells as their breakers, you better hope you opened evenly matched against it, or you just lose. And the weird thing about it is it's not even the fact that games only last one or two turns. It's the fact that the turns are also very long, right? It's not like you can look at your hand and say, okay, I didn't open two hand traps, I'm going second. Or let's say I'm going second, I have no hand traps, my opponent's going first. Let's see if I've lost the game. Let's see if they have enough. It's not like you're waiting 30 seconds to a minute to figure that out. You're usually watching them combo for 5 to 10 minutes of like real-time Yu-Gi-Oh, which is just insane in a game where you have 40, now 45 minutes to play your full match. It's like, unless you know that you've lost the game, you're like sitting there for 5 to 10 minutes. Then you'll probably spend 5 to 10 minutes either thinking or trying to play through this board before you know who wins or not. And then two turns have gone by and it's 30 minutes into the match and you have 10 minutes or I guess now 15 minutes to finish two other games. It's just, it's crazy. It's crazy. It's too much. Like it's, and it all comes down to power creep. Really. It all comes down to power creep. And again, I know this is super rambly. I'm sorry. Yu-Gi-Oh is not a bad game. By any stretch of the imagination, though. That is something I have to say. This is going to be very heavy on complaints, but Yu-Gi-Oh! Is not a bad game by any stretch, or else it wouldn't be as big as it is. But it's power creep in card design, and Anti-Spell is something that I want to take as a great example. Anti-Spell is an old card, right? And you may not know that if you're new to the game, but Anti-Spell is an old card. It came out a long time ago. I don't even know when, but it's old. And it wasn't very good when it came out, or I guess I don't want to say it wasn't very good, but it wasn't very heavily played, right, just across the game in general, as like now it's a staple side deck card for the most part. You'll see it pop up all the time, and the reason for that is because games went on so long, right, 5, 6, 8, 10 plus turns in the early days, and you're not just OTKing people unless your deck is specifically designed to do just that. Activating Anti-Spell doesn't really accomplish much other than delaying the game by one turn, right? In modern Yu-Gi-Oh!, if I flip Anti-Spell on you going first and you can't play, you are dead on turn three. You are just absolutely dead. Game's over. That's why Anti-Spell is so good. Rewind 15 years. I flip Anti-Spell on you. Maybe you have to set your spells and not really do too much for a turn, but then I'm not killing you, right? And then on my turn, I'm under Anti-Spell. So it's not like I can activate my spells if I draw them or something to, you know, push more and try to kill you. I have to set, if I draw a spell off the top that I want to activate, I have to set it too. I'm under Anti-Spell. And if I can't kill you, it goes back to you, and now you can activate your spells, and you can go off and do stuff, right? And then if you don't kill me, you know, it swings back around to me. And that, so like all it really does is delay the game by a turn, which is valuable for tempo, but back in the day is not just going to result in an auto win. Tempo was big. It always has been, but it's not the be all end all like it is now. Right. And I think that's a perfect example of like the game itself power creeping so much that you can OTK basically in every single like relevant meta deck. Like you have very simple lines, maybe not simple. That's probably not the right word, but you have easy access uninterrupted to lines that are going to OTK your opponent very easily. And I guess just kind of like an example of where I think power creep has gone too far, right? I kind of want to turn to Magic the Gathering as an example here, and kind of just the roles that cards play in general, right? In a card game, or in Yu-Gi-Oh! If you want to say, you have cards that are offensive, you have cards that are defensive. Right, an offensive card is something that exerts a lot of pressure on the board or like threatens your opponent's life points. Like for example, if on turn one I summoned a monster with 8,000 attack, right, that exerts a ton of offensive pressure onto my opponent, because if they can't get rid of it, or they can't put up any monsters on their side of the field, or they can't, you know, whatever, I can attack them for game. That's offense. Right, you also have defensive cards like a trap. Solemn Judgment, for example, is a great defensive card because it negates something your opponent does. And I think these things should probably be kept separate when possible. And this is where the Magic example comes in. So first of all, I'm not a Magic expert, so hey, I may be talking out of my butt here. I don't know. But when I did hop in and when I did play some Magic, it was in the Modern format. And it was shortly after Counterspell was printed in Modern and released into that format. Counterspell costs 2 blue mana, and it basically says counter target spell. So it's the equivalent of Solemn Judgment if you're completely unfamiliar. There's no like life point cost or anything like that, but it's basically Solemn Judgment. You can, you know, everything in Magic is considered a spell other than a land, right? So like you can use it to counter creatures being summoned or cast, as they would say. You can use it to counter sorceries, instants, whatever. And it's a purely defensive card, right? Once you use the counter spell, it goes to the graveyard. You lose it. You can't use it again. It doesn't have any attack. It doesn't have any defense. It doesn't sit on the board. So it is a purely defensive card used to answer something that your opponent tries to do, right? And then on the flip side of that, you can look at something like, What's it called? It's in Jund. Tarmogoyf, which is a creature that gets bigger basically by the amount of card types that are in the graveyards as far as like its attack and defense. That is a purely offensive card, right? It exerts pressure onto the board because if it has 6 attack, that's a lot, right? That's almost a third of somebody's life total being 20. And you know, it doesn't do anything else. It just sits there. It has big attack that you can swing with, take out creatures, take out your opponent's life, etc., etc. Yu-Gi-Oh! Has taken offensive cards and defensive cards and mixed them together and made their offense and defense stronger at the same time, right? Let's go back to old Yu-Gi-Oh! For a second. Your defensive cards, those are things like traps. Those are things like spells that can, like, wipe the board, answer a threat, whatever. And your offensive cards were monsters. They were vanillas. They didn't really have effects early on, very early on, I guess I would say. So, like, you summon a 7-colored fish. All it is an 1800 attack monster. That's it, right? So it sits there and exerts offensive pressure to your opponent because it threatens their life points. And obviously, if you reduce their life points to 0, you win. Your monsters are offense. Your spells and traps are defense. Or your spells and traps could be used to, like, augment your offense, right, with, like, an equip spell. And same thing with traps. You know, they kind of bounce back and forth between them. But generally, monsters were offense, your other cards were defense. And now you look at something like, let's talk Ultimate Conductor Tyranno, because this is something I wanted to use in an example later. And what's crazy about this card is nuts, and Dino still is, like, barely seen, right, in even with its new support at all in the meta. Ultimate Conductor Tyranno, 3,500 attack, so it already exerts a ton of offensive pressure onto the board. It can attack all of your opponent's monsters that they control once each. Okay, even more offensive pressure onto the board. It has an effect that can flip your opponent's cards face down, and then, you know, if you attack into, what is it, a defense position monster, you can just do 1,000 and send it to the grave. More offensive pressure, but the key thing here is its effect to do that, to flip your opponent's monsters face down, is a quick effect. So it's also defensive because you can use it to stop, you can use it to stop a play that your opponent is going to make, right? If I summon, what's something that has a link one? Like a Scareclaw monster, right? If I summon a Scareclaw monster, normal summon it, you can just activate UCT, flip my thing face down. I used my normal summon. I can't link summon with something face down. It ended my turn as a defensive card. And then when it swings back around to you, you have so much offensive pressure that you get to just end the game immediately, right? And Magic, I'm sure, has some examples of cards too that kind of can fill both roles, can be used offensively and defensively. But I think personally, that's one of the biggest, not the act itself of mixing an offensive and defensive card together in one card, but by making them both extremely strong as well, right? I would expect a card that is versatile, that can be used offensively and defensively, to be less powerful, But Yu-Gi-Oh! Has kind of just taken all of that offense, defense, mixed it together, and made both of those sides of the coin more powerful at the same time, which is just crazy, right? I can't imagine in Magic casting a creature for even like 3 or 4 mana, right, that sits there and then also for free lets you counterspell your opponent, you know, once per turn or whatever, while also having like 8 attack or something. It's just crazy. It's just crazy. You have cards that just fulfill every role. Kashtira Fenrir is probably like the go-to example that I always go to for power creep of how Yu-Gi-Oh! Is and will have to be going forward. I mean, it's a free special, first of all, so it doesn't use your normal summon. It is 2,400 attack, I think, right? And that's not something to like laugh at, right? Like, that's solid attack. It can attack over pretty much any normal summoned thing. Outside of Fluwandaries, of course. Let me get a drink real quick. So it's already offensive pressure in that sense. You can also use it to search a Kashtira card, or if you're just playing Fenrir, search itself. So it's free. It doesn't even cost you the single card that it takes to use it, right? It literally replaces itself in your hand. And on top of that, it's got an effect where if your opponent activated a monster effect on the resolution, you can banish, what is it, a monster they control? I don't think it's a card, thank God. I think it's a monster they control. Which is a defensive effect, because even if you just summon Fenrir, use it to search itself and pass, you have disruption to stop your opponent from doing something, to remove a threat from the board if they play into it. And the craziest thing, it's got 2 ways to trigger that effect. If it declares an attack, you also get to do that same thing, right? So it just exerts so much pressure, because if you summon it into a board, you search a card, right? It replaces itself. You attack something, trigger its effect to banish something, so you're now +2 off of that interaction already, and that 2,400 attack is going to run over something else. So you're now +3, you know, off of your opponent based off of just that one Fenrir. It's crazy. It's crazy. And I actually want to talk about, I think, my favorite example of a card that Konami made that is very, very, very good and very strong, but not broken. And it is probably my favorite designed boss monster of all time, and it is Hieratic Seal of Heavenly Spheres, the Link 2 that dragons make. And to examine that card a little bit, and I'm going to compare it to Ultimate Conductor Tyranno in a bit. To examine that card a little bit, let me actually look it up here on the Yu-Gi-Oh! Card database to make sure that I don't misspeak in what it is. Blah, blah, blah. Filler words. Until this is loading. Oh my gosh, dude, this is the slowest thing ever. Okay, anyway, it's a Link to Heavenly Spheres. It's a Link to, it requires 2 dragon monsters to make. Its attack is 0, no defense, of course, because it's a Link. It points, you know, diagonal down. Its effect, once per turn, if this card is in the extra monster zone, quick effect, you can tribute 1 monster from your hand or field, return 1 face-up card on the field to the hand. Second effect, if this card is tributed, special summon 1 dragon monster from your hand or deck, then make its attack defense 0. You can only use this effect once per turn. So, first of all, it's not extremely generic, right? 2 dragons is generic enough that different decks can get use out of this card, but it's not so generic like Appaloosa, where any deck that can put monsters on the field has a case to just throw Appaloosa in the extra deck and make it as part of its end board, right? So that's another thing to speak of for Yu-Gi-Oh! 2 that could help with this power creep issue. And it's, you know, nobody really likes, at least from what I've heard, these similar decks that just end on generic boss monsters all the time, right? Like, everyone's like, it's much cooler when they use their own in archetype one. So, you know, there is something to be said with Yu-Gi-Oh! I think having a problem with things being too generic. But anyway, once per opponent's turn, if this card is in the extra monster zone, you know, you can do the effect. That is also a limiting factor in itself. I'll give you an example. In the Draco Slayer deck profile I had on YouTube not too long ago, I would make this card as part of my end board, but the only way that I could make that happen is by sinking a bunch of resources into making a Zealantis to banish the field and then summon everything back to clear up the extra monster zone, because obviously I had to make stuff like Beyond the Pendulum first to even be able to really play. And so I had to go to great lengths, basically, right, to add this card as part of my end board. And honestly, for a lot of decks, that effect right there, if this card is in the extra monster zone, or that condition, can invalidate this card's use in a bunch of different things, right? Because you can't just make it at the end of your combo if you're doing anything involving Lynx, because your extra monster zone is going to be taken up. You have to find some way to get your extra monster zone clear to make this, or you have to make this early, which is going to limit, maybe some of the other things you want to do if you're having to spend resources to go into this before you do anything else. So it's a really cool limiting factor. It's also cool because you can't like Monster Reborn it and then get its effect again. You can't cheese it like that, and you can't just summon three of these things either, because although it's only the second effect that's once per turn, you can't use the first if it's not in the extra monster zone. So I already think that's really well designed as it is. I think it's really cool that it's not a negate, right? I think that's one of the biggest problems in Yu-Gi-Oh! 2 is things are about negates, negates, negates for the most part. You do have formats where that is not the case, but negates are big. And I don't think a negate that doesn't cost anything is good or should destroy, right? It's negate and destroy, or negate and banish or something. That's pretty crazy. I think negating something on its own is already a really good effect. I think negating something for free, just because it's the effect on the monster, is insane. And I think a card to negate a card and destroy it for free is just completely ridiculous, honestly. Without the proper setup to go into it. Obviously, that's part of it too. If you're spending like five cards out of your hand to make a card that does that, that's much different than just doing it in the middle of a combo that only took one card to start and ends you on four of those things, right? But, I've been a proponent of like, if interactions or disruptions are less negate focused, then I think you probably have a better game, because people, I think, would feel less like you can't do anything and you can just do some things, or you have to play around things. But anyway, it returns one face-up card on the field to the hand. Great thing about that is it's not a strong enough effect on its own to completely end a turn, right, against a meta deck, but it's a very good one and it's very versatile, right? It's not negate and destroy something your opponent does. It's just return a face-up card on the field to the hand. Non-targeting, non-destruction removal is great. So anything that you really need to out, you can out it with this. You can use it on continuous spells, on field spells, to make sure that those things don't resolve. And you can use it on your own cards, right? If you were to get like evenly matched or something, right? You can chain Heretic Seal of Heavenly Spheres, tribute itself, and return another card on your side of the field back to your hand that you want to keep, resolve evenly matched, banish your stuff, and then this second effect, which is what makes this card borderline, I think, broken, if you want to call it that, is that if this card is tributed, you can special summon one dragon monster from your hand or deck and make its attack and defense zero, right? So that effect is amazing as well in its versatility. It doesn't negate the effects of the monster you summon. In exchange, the attack and defense of that monster are dropped to zero permanently, but you can do a lot of things with this. You can extra deck lock with Sloth. I played three of this card in Dragon Maid. You can summon a maid, get an effect, and play the advantage game. You can summon, I forget what it's called, but there's one that banishes cards. I think there's a couple that do that. Or you can summon something like an Absa Router to like let it die and get a search or something, right? It's just so versatile with what you can summon from the deck to get extra use out of this card. But the ultimate balancing thing, in my opinion, that I want to talk about, that I think Yu-Gi-Oh! Could implement really easily, the most easily, is this card's attack is zero. It's just zero, right? It exerts zero offensive pressure onto the board by itself, right? You can't use this card's effect on your turn, right? The bounce to hand. So you're not going to make it and then use it as removal. You're making it to then wait to disrupt something your opponent does next turn. This card is defensive in nature, right? But the thing is, if your opponent plays through this card, right, or even if this card by itself stops them, you're not going to kill them just based off of that, because this card's effect or this card's attack is zero. The card that it summons from deck, its attack and defense are also zero. It's not like you can just summon, you know, an 8,000 attack monster and swing for game. It's not Ultimate Conductor Tyranno that if you don't answer right now and get rid of, you just die, on top of it having these disruption effects, right? So I just think this card is super well balanced, and I think if you were to take the cards in Yu-Gi-Oh! That have these type of effects, disruptions, whatever you want to call it, I think if you gave them zero attack or low attack, I think it would do a lot for the health of the game, right? And there's so many cards out there. Like, it just feels like we're so far past the point of return when it comes to that. But, you know, I also really came to this conclusion when I started testing out Sprite for the first time. Deck felt incredibly strong, right? I think we talked about it on an episode, and it was like an 80% win rate or something like that that I had with it. But it did feel a little difficult at times to be able to get over my opponent's things. And some of my losses were because I couldn't do that, right? The Sprite monsters all have fairly low attack. And with the Sprite monsters by themselves, to get high attack, you have to make a Link 2, then use that Link 2 to make Gigantic Sprite, which will bump it up to 3,200. If that's not enough, I mean, what else are you doing, right? You have to spend two more monsters, make a Cat Shark, and resolve Cat Shark's effect to double the Gigantic Sprite to 64. And obviously that's good enough to run over anything, but that's one, that's two monsters to make a Link 2, a third to make Gigantic Sprite, and then two more to make Cat Shark. So that's five total cards that you've invested to get over something like an Ultimate Conductor Tyranno, right? And I mean, obviously, like, I'm just saying by battle, like, obviously you can get rid of them other ways. But it was a real limiting factor for the deck. Another deck I used to play a lot of, Trickstar, right? It felt like that. It could control the game really well and, you know, hand rip and do all that stuff. But if you could stick a monster on board that was over Cantina's 1800 attack, this is before Korabane came out, it was really difficult to deal with. And, you know, imagine your opponent making a board of like three negates, right? But imagine they all have 500 attack. Almost any normal summonable monster that you have in your hand can threaten any of those negates, if not, and if you can get multiple monsters out, it can threaten more of them, right? So I think it would give a really interesting choice to the person playing against these disruption effects, instead of just, oh, I just lose because I can't out these things. It's like, okay, do I want to spend monsters from my hand to get field presence to attack over these things before I try to resolve my good effects? And it would also, I think, solve a lot of the problem of like, well, if I don't play through this immediately, I just lose, because if the negating monsters or the disruptive monsters only have a little bit of attack or no attack, you can just pass and build up card advantage, right? Because they're not going to kill you with those cards. They have to invest even more to make offensive cards, right? Cards that can actually damage your life points significantly. So it's like an interesting choice on both players' end. The one playing theoretically the disruptive cards is like, well, is it worth playing these cards, or do I want to be more offensive and put up and exert a lot of pressure onto the board? And again, just talked on the flip side, it's, do I want to commit to the board and try to either play through these disruptions and answer them? Or do I want to play very passively and try to work through these disruptions slowly over the course of a game, knowing that I'm not going to die immediately, right? And so I just think this card is really well designed, Hieratic Seal of Heavenly Spheres. I think, you know, you compare it to something like Ultimate Conductor Tyranno, and or even Baron. Baron might even be a better example, right? It's got a defensive effect in its negate. It's got a defensive effect in its pop, which you can actually use, you know, to combo off with your own stuff. But also, it's just huge. 3,000 attack. Imagine Baron with a zero attack, right? It's not as threatening. And maybe there's a balance there. Maybe, I think, you know, the easy counterpoint to that would be, well, if you do that, then nobody is going to ever play those cards, and Yu-Gi-Oh! Just becomes a who can summon the biggest monster and beat each other down. So, you know, of course, there is definitely a middle ground there that you want to go to. But like, Power Creep, man, is just, it's just crazy. I remember back in the day when all a card needed to be good and to be really good was to have an archetype searching effect, right? Or like a Manju or something. You normal summon it, add a ritual monster or spell or whatever to your hand. And that's a good card. Stratos was banned for a long time, probably for other things, but, you know, at its core, it's a searcher, right? And I remember, you know, that's the thing that you would look for in an archetype. Oh, it's got a searcher. Okay, that's good, right? That's a good card. And now you, again, you just have Fenrir, which is a searcher, plus it's offensive pressure, plus it's a free special, plus it's defensive. Like, it's just too much. It's just too much. So that's my boomer complaint, I guess. And I don't even really qualify as a Yugi boomer because, you know, 2016 wasn't that long ago. But I just feel like the cards themselves have gotten so strong that, you know, it's just the constant cycle of Konami making cards that are insanely strong, then having to make cards that are even more insanely strong to counter them, which is why we have so many breakers, you know, like Lightning Storm, Raigeki being back, Evenly Matched, Dark Ruler no more, Sphere Mode, you know, whatever. I guess Sphere Mode doesn't count because that was out for a long time. Kurikara, Div Incarnate, all this stuff that's designed to just blow out your opponent going second. It doesn't solve anything, right? It just feeds the vicious cycle of, what was I going to say? I just lost my train of thought. Vicious cycle, yeah. It just feeds the vicious cycle of, like, of one-sidedness, right? If I open three breaker cards, you know, it's not like you're going to put up more than, you know, two hard negates, right? If even that. And in this format right now, it's less negate focused than it usually is, right? So, like, I can resolve these breakers, and if I open one or two, it's just over in that sense too, right? You can combo off as much as you want. Here's a Dark Ruler plus Evenly Matched. Now I win, now you lose, right? So it's not even like too one-sided on the person that goes first. It's just too one-sided in general. And even lately, the last few locals and events that I've played at, it just really feels like even you get into game two, game three, it's like either I will draw my sided cards, my blowouts, and win, or I won't and I don't. And that's it. And that just sucks when you boil the game down to that simplicity of just like, hey, let's just draw our opening hands, reveal them to each other, and we can know who wins right off the bat, right? I think a longer game with less powerful cards leads to, you know, a longer game in general leads to more decisions being made. When there are more decisions to be made, I think more skill comes into play because if you don't make the right decisions, you get punished. If you make the right decisions, you get rewarded. So I think it really rewards skill. But anyway, yeah, the one-sidedness, the power creep, I wish it wasn't there as much. I wish games were longer. The decks that I play are all basically designed to get to a game state where I can have fun like that and make those kind of decisions because, you know, you look at Sky Striker, it's grindy. You look at Labyrinth, same thing. Yes, it does have some blowouts if you resolve like a D barrier or a Ku Klok play into like Eradicator or something. But, you know, by and large, it's a trap deck as long as you're not playing like Floodgates. You know, you're just trading cards into your opponent to gain advantage. And outgrind them, essentially. And man, I didn't know I've been going for 47 minutes. The only other thing I want to talk about is like the biggest solution, in my opinion, to Yu-Gi-Oh! And it's alternate formats. It's real easy. It's real simple. I started thinking this after I transitioned over to Magic. Just, you know, not transitioned over, but after I started playing Magic a little bit. And it just feels awesome to know if I don't like the modern scene where it is right now, I can go play Standard. If I don't like Standard, I can go play Legacy. I can go play Vintage. You know, obviously, to play some of those things in paper would cost me an arm and a leg. But, you know, you have alternate formats. Pioneer is another one. Commander, of course, the most popular Magic format, right? It's just, you have so many different ways to go. And I feel like if I have an itch to scratch in Magic, if Modern doesn't do it, there's going to be something out there that does. Whether it's building a Commander deck, building a Standard deck and playing that, whatever. Yu-Gi-Oh! Doesn't really have anything like that. It has a theoretical traditional format where everything is at one at the very least. But I don't really see any tournaments or anything, any events supported for that. There is Edison, right, which some of you guys have said we really need to get into, and I agree. I would love to. I don't think there's any Edison events near me, right? So it's kind of tough. It's like, well, I'd love to get into it, but I can't play it anywhere except online. And, you know, I don't mind playing online, but I'd obviously rather play in person. But You know, just imagine if Yu-Gi-Oh! Had something like this. It has a format like we have now where you get to play with, you know, every card that's released, I guess, is in the format with this ban list. This is one format. You could call it modern, even, because it's the most modern form of the game. And then imagine you had, like, these legacy formats, Edison, and it's a couple years span of cards and before that you can use. Maybe even earlier than that, right? You have, like, Metal Raiders format or GOAT format, or, you know, Burning Abyss, Shadal, Duelist Alliance format, right? Necroz format. There's a lot of different formats that people look back on extremely fondly in Yu-Gi-Oh! And I think it would be really cool if they split up the game like that and then could release product for different formats, right? You could make these insane cards that people, you know, if people want to play Solitaire combo off for 10 minutes versus each other and play this, in my opinion, like, extremely one-sided, less skillful, theoretically, game, then, like, go for it, right? Well, maybe not less skillful. The skills are just different, and I don't like the skills that it requires now as much. But let them do it, and let people like me, who, and I'm not even glorifying when I hopped in the game as the ultimate time. I don't think it was, right? Like, the game, when I first started competing, like, a regional was Metal Foes. And, you know, that was a combo deck by, you know, by all means, right? So it definitely wasn't perfect. But even earlier than that, maybe Edison is the one. Maybe Edison is the thing. And I think Konami has gotten a little bit better about that. I have heard of different side events that they have done for things. But it'd be awesome to get full support for different formats. I do remember them trying to do something like that. What was there, like, a common charity or something format? There's also some alternate rule sets too in Yu-Gi-Oh! Trinity format, like a Highlander format would be really cool. You know, whatever, etc. I just think that that's where Yu-Gi-Oh! That's where the future should go. And I think if they go in that direction, Yu-Gi-Oh! Is set. Yu-Gi-Oh! Is just set for life. It's cool. The way it is now, I do think there is at some point going to be an endpoint. There just has to be, because, like, we're already seeing that, you know, playing on turn zero, not even having hand traps to stop your opponent on their turn one, but, like, you being able to play on their turn one. Tier Element was the first that I remember that's real big about that, right? Rescue Ace can do that too. And, you know, at this point, you need specific cards to do it, right? It's not just, like, every hand you open, but, like, that's kind of the natural endpoint of this, is both decks, there's no turns anymore. Both decks have a bunch of cards and effects that can be activated as a quick effect at any point in the game, and everything is resolved on turn zero, or turn one, I guess you would say. And maybe that's a good thing, right? I've kind of toyed around with that idea of, like, well, what if Yu-Gi-Oh! Just didn't have turns? What if you just were able to play things, right? It's a really interesting thought experiment, and obviously probably doesn't work in Yu-Gi-Oh! Right now, but, like, just a card game in general, right, where you just have no turns. You can just play things as quick effects all the time. Maybe it feels more interactive that way. I don't know, but, you know, it just, I can't remember the last format where I felt like I could sit down and have a good, nice, grindy, skillful game against the opponent. I think it was when Sky Striker was the best deck, was the last time, which was, what, 2018, maybe 19? So, you know, 4 years now. And before that, I don't even know if that was a thing, right? I wasn't even really good enough to recognize those things before I started playing Striker, so... You know, it is what it is, and, you know, one thing that should be said is, like, that's just my personal opinion, right? There are other people, even if you've come into the game recently, right, you might love it. You might see no problems with the game. That's totally fine. That's totally fine. Like I said, this might just be the Yugi boomer in me that everybody may go through at some point where it's like, man, the game just is too, it's too far past what I came in with, but I don't know. I don't know. I think I'm going to call it there, though. I could keep rambling. I'm sure there's some stuff I wanted to say but forgot. But, man, I hate doing these episodes where I don't have anything structured out. It just feels so freaking rambly. Like, I feel like this episode sucked. But I know I've said that before, and you guys are like, no, it's fine. It's fine. It's cool. So, so we'll roll with it anyway. We'll roll with it anyway. Don't know what I'm gonna do next yet. I know some of you guys have given some content suggestions. Maybe I'll work those all into a thing. But I think that's going to do it for this one. It'll be dropping Wednesday morning for y'all, and I'm going to try my best to have the next episode ready on Monday, and the next episode after that might be that final Q&A. So if you have any questions at all for me about the scapegoats, about Yu-Gi-Oh!, about me, about life, about anything, keep them in mind, and I think next week I will start asking for those to answer on the last episode. So anyway, thank you guys, as always, so much for your support. And yeah, think that's going to call it. And I will catch you in the next one.